From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, recent protests took place outside of the White House, led by environmental activist and author Bill McKibben, over the $7 billion proposal to build a 1,700-mile oil pipeline from Canada's tar sands in Alberta to the Gulf of Mexico. The largest civil disobedience action of the environmental movement in years, the protests led to arrests, including that of Bill McKibben, who will join us in the hour ahead, along with Bay Area-based environmental activist Paul Hawken. And we'll discuss the pipeline, the protests, climate change, and other environmental issues with these two leading figures of the environmental movement. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. Two environmental leaders, both heroes in the environmental movement, join us in studio in this morning's second Forum hour, fresh from an arrest for a protest he helped organize outside of the White House against the building of the Transcontinental XL pipeline. Bill McKibben is here with us, and so is Bay Area environmentalist and author and entrepreneur Paul Hawken. Both have been passionate advocates against global warming and the baleful effects of climate change, and both are leading figures in the fight for clean and sustainable alternative energies. Bill McKibben and Paul Hawken are both here, and we welcome both of you. Glad to have you. Let me go through a little more bona fides. Bill McKibben is also the founder of 350.org, an international climate campaign. His latest book is Earth, Making a Life on a New Planet. Other books include The End of Nature. And both Bill McKibben and Paul Hawken will be at the Commonwealth Club today at noon as part of the club's Climate One series, although I believe it is a sold-out event. But mention it anyway, Paul Hawken. Environmentalist, entrepreneur, author, founder, and former CEO of Smith & Hawken, currently CEO of One Sun Solar. And his books include Blessed Unrest and The Ecology of Commerce. Again, glad to have you both here. And Bill, let me begin with you. This is the biggest, as you've described, a civil disobedience action of the environmental movement in many years against the Keystone XL pipeline and trying to defuse a carbon bomb and trying to get President Obama to be the one to defuse it.
Yeah, the last couple of weeks have been pretty dramatic and interesting. We had daily protests outside the White House for 2 weeks, and by the time we were done, 1,253 people had been arrested. What was interesting was, among many other things, these were not the usual suspects. We asked everybody when they signed up. I thought it'd be rude to ask how old they were, so we said, "Who was president when you were born?" Okay. And the biggest cohorts were from the FDR and Truman years. The last day, our oldest arrestee, 86, was arrested with a sign around his neck that said, "World War II vet, handle with care." I mean, he'd been born in the Harding administration. There's this upsurge of some kind of mixture of deep frustration and fear and also a certain kind of hope that maybe somehow we can conjure up the President Obama that we were inspired to go out
You're
and work for.
Still wearing the campaign buttons, weren't you?
many people were arrested with their Obama 08 buttons. In fact, when I was in jail at Central Cell Block in D.C. for a couple of days, a place that's exactly as much fun as it sounds like it might be, the guy who was – there was a older guy lying on in the steel slab next to mine, in this 100-degree heat, sort of twisting and turning, trying – there's no mattress or pillow or anything, trying to find some comfortable way to sleep for a couple of nights. And he said, "You know what? The last time I was this uncomfortable, I was in a church basement waiting to go knock on doors for Barack Obama. I really would like to be reminded why."
Well, these people, I think, who are out there with you protesting and putting themselves on the line and being civilly disobedient must have been taking not only 350.org at its word that this was a major battle, but also people like James Hansen who said this is game over for the climate if it goes through this pipeline.
Well, let's talk about climate for a minute because, I wrote the first book about it 22 years ago. And at that time, it was still kind of theoretical. It's not theoretical anymore. Just look at
Governor
the last
Texas
year.
Says it's theoretical.
Well, the governor of Texas said last night that, Galileo was on number, but somehow the governor of Texas got it sort of backwards. Galileo was the scientist, It was the politicians of his day that turned out to be wrong, as they will turn out to be wrong here. The science is
– excuse me, Bill, yeah. But just for the sake of listeners, what I'm referring to is last night in the Republican presidential debate – Texas Governor Rick Perry was asked if he believes man-made climate change is happening. And for those of you who didn't hear it, we're just going to hear it now.
The science is not settled on this. The idea that we would put Americans' economy at jeopardy based on scientific theory that's not settled yet, it is nonsense. I mean, I tell somebody, I said, just because you have a group of scientists that have stood up and said, here is the fact, Galileo got outvoted for a spell.
It would be hard to get it more backward than that. And, you know, the idea that we're going to put the economy at jeopardy, the country is currently in jeopardy. I mean, Texas just came through. They're in the middle of the worst drought ever. They had fires 2 days ago, and the head of the Texas Forest Fire Service said, and I quote, "No human being has ever fought forest fires in conditions like this. The level of dryness and the lack of humidity is more." Meanwhile, on the east coast of the United States, yesterday, that huge swath of territory up from about Binghamton down. They not only broke their old rainfall records, some cities broke them by 60% as the remnants of, in this case, Tropical Storm Lee and Tropical Storm Cadia combined to drop just ungodly amounts of water. My home state of Vermont 2 weeks ago all but washed away. Though I was in Washington at the time, it was hard to be there because I was on the phone with neighbors saying there's no way into town. They were dropping food by helicopter to people in the surrounding towns. I mean, that's one of the things that's really moving people. And so when we see a pipeline like this, it goes to the second largest pool of carbon on the planet after the oil fields of Saudi Arabia. Burning the oil fields of Saudi Arabia got us in the trouble we're in now. If we go whole hog the same way again, you're right. As Jim Hansen at NASA said, it's essentially game over for the climate.
And I don't know if Rick Perry really does have the pipeline of God, because he was doing a lot of open prayer about doing something about the aridness of Texas. That's a bit of an editorial comment, but understand the pipeline. When you said pipeline, made me think this is a man who does at least.
I'm a Methodist Sunday school teacher, right? So prayer's good by me, but the general theological understanding is prayer works better if you're not constantly doing all the things to undermine that prayer all the time, you know?
Look,
God helps those who help themselves, as Ben Franklin pointed out once upon a time.
I know Governor Perry is a good target for you, particularly after what we heard. But what about the argument that there really are jobs, thousands of jobs? And certainly, as far as the economy, maybe not only generating jobs, but generating great revenue by the pipeline.
Well, sure. There's jobs to be had. It's going to take some people to build this pipeline. The backers of it are saying, the Chamber of Commerce said, hundreds of thousands of jobs. In fact, when the State Department looked at it, they said there'll be about 5,000 temporary jobs created. That's nothing to sneeze at. But what it means is that we delay for another generation making the transition to the job-rich renewable energy forms that we desperately need. Look, the liquor store in Saudi Arabia is starting to run out, okay? So the question is now, are we going to sober up and do something else, or are we going to find another liquor store and binge for another 25 years? And if we do that, we're not going to create jobs in the long run. We're just going to keep down this same path that clearly is going nowhere.
Again, Bill McKibben here with us, activist, author, founder of 350.org, and it's an international climate campaign that was involved under his leadership with the recent protests and the arrests that went on in Washington. Let's get Paul Hawken on here. What do you think about this idea of using civil disobedience to protest?
Well, it has a rich history, of course. You've had Adam Hochschild on this program many times, and he wrote a really important book called Bury the Chains.
Adam Hochschild.
Yeah, where he really talked about the origins of civil disobedience in the sense of civil society, not the origins of civil disobedience in a Gandhian, Thoreauvian sense, but in the sense for the first time in the abolitionist movement, people got together to work on behalf of the future, to work on behalf of people they didn't know and from whom they would never receive direct or indirect benefit. And this meme, if you will, this social technology has spread and spread and spread and is a huge worldwide movement which is unremarked upon because to the media it's boring. Unless something happens, like an arrest or a clash. But I think it's important to understand that civil society goes to arrests and this level of protest when it's exhausted all of the means. It's the default mode, not the first mode. And I think what Bill's doing and what's happening in Washington, D.C., is the first international climate movement that has begun. And I think that the next stage, and I'm not giving advice here, I'm praying in a way, but is for it to spread to the Obama headquarters in different states and the Democratic headquarters in different states so that people have the sense that it's widespread.
Just where I was going to go with you, because as Bill has pointed out publicly, President Obama can refuse to grant the permit. He doesn't need Congress. He could do it by himself. So this was not only an attempt to bring attention to the cause, but also to get the president on board here. And I wonder if you agree. Recently, former Vice President Gore was very critical of President Obama for not making climate change enough of an issue. You feel the same way?
I do. And I'm not sure what's going on with President Obama. I don't know him. I had no contact with him. I've been involved with previous Democratic administrations, but not this one. But the thing that strikes me is that in his attempt to be, in a sense, the center and appease, he is satisfying no one. And it really kind of goes to this idea of what's a bounded rationality, this idea that if you, in a sense, are a satisficer, if you satisfy different entities, that somehow you're going to create a better system. And you don't. You pessimize the system. And what we're talking about here is a fundamental change in values and a systemic change. And that requires leadership as opposed to appeasement. And what we're seeing here with the Keystone XL pipeline is basically a president caving if he does make a positive decision. And if the pipeline worked as advertised, at least there would be an argument. There would be a fair argument, which is, well, jobs and more energy security and less dependence on the Mideast and so forth. But none of those things are true. The fact is the pipeline goes down to the Gulf to be made into diesel that's going to be shipped to Latin America and Europe. So it's not even going to come to us, and it's going to have no effect on prices, has no effect on energy security for the United States. And yet the forces at play seem to have the upper hand in terms of influencing the State Department and the president.
We also have to squeeze the oil out of the tar of these sands. I mean, that's a conversion process that really releases about three times more of CO2s than, say, typical oil production. But I wonder, you probably saw Robert Redford's piece about President Obama, and it was hopeful, but he said since August, Arctic drilling, the Keystone XL pipeline, which is up for sort of in the air now, and the ozone limits, the regulations on ozone, it would seem, at least on the face of it, that maybe the president is not a strong enough environmentalist as was anticipated or expected during the campaign, or that he's trying to, as you suggest, maybe get a consensus here. But it's also, his defenders say billions in energy stimulus, doubled the gas mileage standards, created a couple million acres of wilderness. In other words, things are kind of both sides here, aren't they?
He's made some extraordinary appointments. Jane Lubchenco at NOAA and John Holdren, a science advisor, and Stephen Chu is a fantastic person, head of DOE. And they have done some really important and constructive things. But at the same time, as president, what we're missing is a leader. And I don't mean to, you know, just point fingers, but there is no person showing up. In a sense, the way actually Perry did last night in the debate, we can fault him for the duplicity and for the contradictions in what he said, but at least he was emphatic. And I think a lot of people are attracted to him just for that reason alone, even though some of what he says is absurd. And I think that sense of emphaticness, of clarity, of conviction, FDR had it. We want it in our president, and we need it on this issue vitally.
Now, how do you feel about the president at this point, Bill? You're sort of it seems like you're sort of holding feelings in abeyance, hoping he's going to come on board on XL.
We're not going to do him the favor of attacking him, okay, and allowing ourselves to be sort of marginalized as we're going to pay him the dangerous compliment of taking him seriously. And we have gone and you know, I mean, people keep showing up with new quotes from the campaign in 2008, the incredibly beautiful words that he used. I mean, the night he clinched the nomination, he said, "In my presidency, if we work together, we will start to slow the rise of the oceans and the planet will begin to heal. We're going to do everything we can to make sure that he lives up to that promise, and I think we're going to refuse to become cynics until we absolutely have to." And I think in many ways that's more difficult for the president and his men to deal with than it would be if we just said, "We're never going to vote for you again. You've betrayed us." We need that Barack Obama, and that, more to the point, we need that. I mean, the campaign was always more beautiful than the candidate in a certain sense anyway. We need that back. Maybe we made a mistake in sort of thinking that all we had to do was elect a president and sort of walk away.
But you need more than the rhetoric. You need the conviction, and you need the ability that he had then to galvanize people, don't you?
And of course, part of the problem is that much of the time he's been completely stymied by an absurd Congress, especially on these issues. I mean, I would go crazy if I had to deal with Jim Inhofe and stuff all the time. So we haven't gone and gotten arrested demanding of him things that he does not have the power to do. In this case, he does have the power, and that's what makes it such a such an interesting moment.
Bill McKibben again, founder of 350.org, and Paul Hawken, now CEO of One Sun Solar. Paul, you led the Garrison Institute discussion and brought up this whole question on climate change that I think with respect to the public, I mean, we've got a public here, we're very spoiled. If they're not enlightened and concerned, they certainly know a good deal. But so many people know so little, you pointed out, and seem to care so little about climate change and what can be done about it.
Yeah, there is this problem about human behavior and systems, and that is humans generally make a decision based on the information they have, their cognitive limitations, and then the amount of time that they have to dedicate to that decision. And when it comes to climate change, which is easily the most complex system, one of the most complex systems there is, people give up. And like Cassandra, you know, warned the Trojans about their looming destruction, and nobody wanted to hear Cassandra. I mean, it's a hard sell, basically, to go out to the public and use fear as a motivating prospect. It doesn't work. And so what happens is that people, this is just all of us, you know, not just people out there in the audience, or I'm talking about myself as well. We tend to want to simplify our decision-making process and simplify the inputs. And then based on that, we go to that decision which is most satisfying to us, which I mentioned earlier, as opposed to the decision that optimizes the whole system or the whole economy or the whole country. And that kind of process is prey to demagoguery, to the Jim Imhoffs, to the Rick Perrys, to the kind of simplistic overstatements or mangling of science that has come to dominate the conversation in the United States. And so what Bill is doing, what 350.org is doing, is to me extremely important because, I mean, if you look at analogies in our history, it's really the women's movement, environmental movement in the past, I mean, certainly the civil rights movement, which is these were not popular issues when they were first taken up by their proponents. They were unpopular, and there was a lot of disapproval and criticism, and yet people stuck to their guns. And it took the kind of the courage that you saw, for example, in the 13-year-olds in the James Pettibone Bridge in Selma. It took for people to see the courage of people again and again subjecting themselves, in a sense, to arrest, to beatings in the case of the civil rights movement, before people actually paid better attention to it and paid attention to the way in a moral way, in a grounded way, in a basis of values and beliefs as opposed to sound bites. And I think the same thing will have to come about in terms of climate change, because unless it does, then the only other thing that really motivates people to really move suddenly from that basis of decision-making is crises. And I've said for years that if we had 2 Force 5 hurricanes go up I-95 in the same year, I think that would make the difference. I don't wish it upon any section of the country or any populace, but I do think that the United States basically is waiting for a crisis to galvanize it, just like we saw in a very odd way but O.J. Simpson was acquitted. But police forces all across the nation changed how they police spousal abuse from that acquittal.
Well, you also have gone on record saying that the right is deluded about climate change. I think you made that very clear. But also you feel that the left is deluded on solutions. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, there is this American exceptionalism that, you know, that suffuses both political parties, but there's also progressive exceptionalism in a way. It's kind of a – that we don't really notice because we're – if we're progressives, we're in it and we think we're right, just like everyone else thinks they're right. But when it comes to renewable energy, we have pursued the wrong path in several areas, and certainly corn ethanol is well known now. Wave power, even if it worked, is just a tiny infinitesimal fraction of what's possible. When we look at solar, we find a technology that was created for outer space, for satellites. It works very well. And as a friend at DOE recently said, still extraterrestrial. It's not a terrestrial technology because it is, along with the Athabasca tar sands, probably the most toxic energy source per kilowatt hour. Except for nuclear when it melts down like Fukushima. So but probably even more importantly than that is it's not renewable because what you're doing with solar is you're taking very high-intensity energy, usually coal in China, in fact, absolutely coal-powered energy, and then you're making a low-intensity energy generator with that that you put on your roof and it's great, it looks nice, it's passive, and you think, well, that's clean energy. But in fact, you can't make solar with solar. It's not renewable. You have to use hydrocarbons to make current solar energy. And I think the last point, which is, again, sort of overlooked, but is critical to this conversation on climate and society and growth and economy and energy, is how much energy is returned for the energy we invest in a technology. And we have all grown up and come into a level of prosperity in a 100-to-1 world where for every unit of energy we put into the ground, we got 100 units out. And that surplus is the feedstock of civilization. And solar is 3 to 5 to 1. Athabasca on a good day is 2 to 3 to 1. We're not sure about the numbers, but it's just so low. And we're comparing that to, say, hunting-gathering societies, which are 10 to 1. So you can't have the kind of world that we're talking about in a 3 to 5 to 1 return on energy invested. That means 20% of all our economy would be going to get energy alone. And so when we look at solar, existing solar, incumbent solar, to me it's a failed technology. $200 billion in subsidies and basically 60% of all solar now is sold to Italy and Germany. Germany is not going to be able to afford it much longer. Italy's bankrupt. I mean, this is a technology that's been propped up. And I do feel, however, that it's absolutely the right technology. That is, streaming photons into electrons is where we have to go. And there's some new nascent technologies down in Silicon Valley that will make it.
Well, where I have to go is to a break. But before I do that, let me give the phone number and invite those of you listening to join us in this conversation with Bill McKibben and Paul Hawken. We do welcome your phone calls, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. You can join us now toll-free, 866-733-6786. Again, we welcome your calls, and it is toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also send an email, forum@kqed.org, or post a question or comment on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And for more coverage of the science and politics of climate change, visit kqed.org/climatewatch. When we return, we'll hear from you, and we'll continue with Bill McKibben and Paul Hawken. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, author and climate change activist Bill McKibben was among hundreds of people arrested at the White House recently at an environmental protest over the proposed Canada-U.S. oil pipeline. McKibben, whose group organized a protest in conjunction with many, many other groups, and it was an international effort, is advocating civil disobedience to demand government action on global warming. He's here with us in studio, along with veteran environmentalist and Bay Area entrepreneur Paul Hawken. We're talking about approaches to tackling climate change, talking really about much more than that, about the environment, of course. And I just wanted to mention a couple of things that you probably ought to know about. United Nations Secretary General said yesterday in a visit to the Solomon Islands that the whole conviction about climate change has been strengthened as a threat to humanity. And I'm quoting him, it is even a threat to international peace and security. And another sort of interesting recent piece of information is a new study put out by Yale and George Mason University asking about belief in global warming and whether or not global warming is happening. Democrats, 78% said yes. Independents, 71%. Republicans, 53%. And Tea Party, 34%. 54% of the Tea Party queried said they don't believe that it is happening. So you can see where the divide is here pretty clearly. About 33%, in fact, of Tea Party members who were queried said that environmental protection, they were asked if it reduces economic growth and costs jobs, and about a third of them said they believe that it does. We're going to find out your thoughts here. I just wanted to get Bill McKibben on record here, though, about, again, talking about how much was consolidated in this demonstration. I mean, you had, like you said, not only people from all age demographics, but all over.
So one of the most interesting things that's happened is that for the very first time in a long time, the whole environmental community is collaborating on a project. We had enormous help that tarsandsaction.org has become the kind of umbrella for this effort for the next few months. And, you know, it's a ton of people from the Bay Area. Rainforest Action Network and Sierra Club and things have all been playing really wonderful parts. When we got out of jail, after the two most significant things that happened after my couple of days in jail, when I walked out, someone handed me a copy of the New York Times with an editorial saying, stop this pipeline. Then I knew we'd begun to make some national headway. The next day, the heads of all the big environmental groups in this country, from the highly corporate-friendly Environmental Defense Fund to the highly corporate-unfriendly Rainforest Action Network, put out a joint letter saying there's not an inch of daylight between us and those protesters out there in front of your house, Mr. President. We expect nothing less than the veto of this pipeline. This is the principal environmental challenge for you between now and the election. And that was very, very good to see, and even better to see that it was, you know, it wasn't just sort of hardcore beltway environmentalists. The environmental kind of justice network, the people who are in the kind of frontline communities, especially the indigenous leaders from all over the country, just really stepping up and saying, we're for once all going to say the same thing, and we're going to say it loudly enough to be heard.
Bill, Paul Hawken, you want to be heard here.
Yeah, just I think it's really important to note that this the tar sands is all dressed up with no place to go if this pipeline doesn't go through. It has two pipelines into the Midwest, and those refineries are at capacity because it's a heavy sour crude. Very few refineries can handle it. It can't get through to British Columbia in its own country. So if the Keystone XL pipeline is stopped, it actually circumscribes the production of the oil in the tar sands because there's really nowhere to put it, nowhere to take it, nowhere to ship it.
Alberta's a long way from
the
rest of the world. And as the energy minister said, if we don't get this pipeline, we're landlocked in oil. That's, frankly, our goal.
Yeah.
One of the nicest things that happened was that though we weren't just being hard on President Obama about this, we were also being pretty hard on the Canadians because they haven't behaved as responsibly as, say, the Brazilians have.
Of course, the Canadians say this is all about energy security, and that's what the opponents of you guys are saying, right?
The good news, I mean, that's the Canadian oil industry saying it. But the good news is that average Canadians are now really beginning to step up. In 2 days, we collected some ungodly number of signatures from Canadians writing to President Obama saying, look, our oil-soaked government isn't going to stop this thing. We need you to do it. It's been powerful to see. It's been powerful to see the union movement, who you would think would be completely behind this thing because it's, you know, jobs.
Yeah.
Split right down the middle. There are unions saying, no, we want nothing to do with it. And one of the reasons is that they've come to realize that the people who benefit from this, say the Koch brothers who have a big refinery or big oil operation up there in Alberta, will use every penny that they make from these, you know, from tar sands oil to do everything they can to wipe out the union movement. So it's a very, very, very interesting moment.
You know who else you got help from? You had some movie stars out there. I mean, let's face it, that makes a difference.
What was interesting is we didn't even really ask them to come, but it wasn't just movies. It was people who had deep connections to this kind of thing. So Margot Kidder showed up. She was born up there in Alberta, you know, in that part of the world.
She used to be married to Pierre Trudeau, in fact, at one point, the Canadian Prime Minister.
A wonderful Native American actress, Tantu Cardinal, also from that part of the world, showed up.
Daryl Hannah?
Daryl Hannah was there, who's, you know, who walks the talk. She's a terrific energy activist in Colorado. It was very good to see that, and we'll need lots more of that going forward.
Let me go to our callers. I think we have somebody from Redwood City, David, who may be challenging some of what we've heard. David, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. As a global warming advocate, I definitely believe in the science, but I must say I was appalled to see Al Gore inject himself as the expert and the spokesman for the global warming movement, because I believe that what that did is it turned it into a political conversation. Now, we're not talking about the science anymore. We're talking about politics. And until we recognize that we are fighting a political battle, I don't think any of the science is going to matter.
Bill McKibben?
Look, Al Gore, I think, did the world a real service. An Inconvenient Truth did a tremendous job of bringing the truth about global warming to a very large audience. And I was really pleased last week when he issued a statement about this tar sands thing. Not easy for Al Gore to take on the sitting president of his party in the White House, and that he said, "Mr. President, you've got to pay attention to these brave people getting arrested outside your house. This tar sands thing is crazy." That was a sign, I think, that in the kind of corridors of power in D.C., people are beginning to think that we actually have a chance to prevail here.
Let me thank the caller and move on to more of your calls. And we're going to go next to Berkeley. Max, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
And thank you for a good program.
Thank you.
And my comment is being questioned by one of your guests. He made the comment, and I apologize for not quite remembering his name correctly. He made the comment that some elements of the progressive community are really promoting the wrong technology, a failed technology, that somehow we're barking up the wrong tree, perhaps. Terrible way to put it. But it's not clear to me. He tossed some ratios at us, and perhaps I would wish him to amplify and clarify his comments. I would greatly appreciate that. I thank you very much. I'll take your comment off the air.
Okay, and the guest you're talking about is Paul Hawken. Paul?
Thank you, Max. The solar technology is the right technology. What I'm talking about is how it's been executed to date. There's no question in my mind that the sun is the basis of all renewable technologies, whether it's wave or wind or solar thermal or solar photovoltaic, and that's what we have to capture. What I'm saying is that the technology that is popular right now is derived from Bell Lab discoveries going back almost 50 years that were developed for satellites. And they are made in a very energy-intensive way. They're made with heavy metals. They're made with greenhouse gases like hexafluorides that are 25,000 times more powerful than CO2 as greenhouse gases. They're made with numerous toxic compounds that basically go into the panels or used to make them. And if some panels are cadmium telluride, CadTel. You have a little Superfund site on your roof. When you put them up there, and there is real issues about what to do with them after their useful life is over. So all I'm suggesting is that we need to move ahead with this technology in a way that has a much lower footprint and a much greater and more positive return in terms of how much energy is used to make it in the first place.
Bill McKibben, you had something
to add. And while we're waiting for I think Paul's going to be supplying his company some of that next generation technology for photovoltaics pretty soon. While we're waiting for that, one thing that everybody can do that really does work, he's been talking about PV technology for your roof for electricity. One thing you can do in the meantime is get those solar hot water panels up there. That's simple technology. Yeah. I was just did a piece for the National Geographic on China and energy. 250 million Chinese now, when they take a shower, the hot water is coming off the roof. And I spent a great day with the guy who runs the biggest of these companies, Heemin Solar, and we talked all afternoon. And then he said, come into my little private museum here. There's something I want to show you. And he led me inside, and in his little private museum, the pride of place was a hot water solar panel that Jimmy Carter put on the roof of the White House in 1978 and Ronald Reagan took down in 1985 because he wanted, you know, manlier forms of energy. Look,
well, Carter kept up that roof stuff with Habit for Humanity.
Absolutely. But we knew how to do this, you know, this kind of stuff, this sort of basic solar hot water
back
stuff.
Back in the 70s.
Yeah, sure. And it's crazy that we haven't pursued that.
What about the pursuit of – how would you give – what kind of grade would you give – I'll ask each of you. Would you give the president in terms of the pursuit of green technology?
Well, look, the president's done a couple of things that are good. He put some money for green stuff into his stimulus, a far smaller percentage than, say, the Chinese, who are really serious about doing this stuff. And the other thing he's done that's useful is, though it's some years out, gotten the auto industry to agree to higher mileage standards. Not all that high, I must say. And, you know, I mean, my Honda Civic Hybrid I've been driving for a decade now gets 50 miles to the gallon. It's sort of lame that by 2020 or something, we're going to be at 35 as a fleet. But, you know, that's good. It wasn't a very heavy political lift because, let's face it, the American government essentially owns the auto industry now. In other places, the president has punted, you know. When it came time to man up on the climate bill or not, he took a powder. He did not engage in that debate. More brutally, earlier this year, he opened up 750 million metric tons of coal in Wyoming under federal land to mining. That's the equivalent of opening up 300 new coal-fired power plants and running them for a year. So when we get to Keystone, I mean, we're getting to something that will – I mean, since we've been able to put some real spotlight on it, I think more than almost any other decision he's made, it's going to tell us where his heart and his instincts are.
Well, good. Paul, you want to say something?
Well, just that
I
think the DOE did some great things under Stephen Chu and did some really things that probably weren't so great, like the $535 million loan to Solyndra down in San Leandro, which just went bankrupt, a technology that every single person I know of in the industry said was going to fail.
It was Fremont, I think.
Yeah. I think the main criticism I have of the president is he didn't make the case to the American people for
– Didn't use his bully pulpit.
Yeah, he didn't use it. Yeah. And for transformation, for economic growth, for energy security, for energy independence, for innovation, for really taking advantage of gumption.
He did use his bully pulpit during the campaign for all these things.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
But if you don't mean it, you shouldn't say it. I think that's sort of the bottom line.
Of course, you can say maybe you're underestimating the political realities, as that caller kind of intimated.
Absolutely, which is why we're only really taking him to task in places where he can do it himself. And this Keystone Pipeline, this tar sands thing, is the perfect example of that.
And, of course, you could argue that he's risking re-election maybe because they can use it against him that he fell down, caved came to having more jobs and all.
I think he's risking re-election probably more the other way. There was a poll out yesterday showing that for the first time, the percentage of people 18 to 29 who approve of the president has dropped below 50%. Those were the people, in essence, who really got him elected. They were the ones out there knocking on doors. They voted in unprecedented numbers and in huge, huge ratios for the president. It's you can't excite people that way and then just walk away from it. He can still reignite that kind of enthusiasm, but it's going to mean being willing once in a while to stand up to the Chamber of Commerce and to the, you know, richest people in this country. That debate between, you know, what you do to get elected, whether you curry favor with the rich or whether you try and get people inspired about things, in a sense, that's what's going on underneath this Keystone fight.
Let me go to some more of our callers. And Bruce, thanks for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Oh, hi, Michael. Am I on?
Yeah, you're on. Hi.
Oh, great. Thanks. First of all, great show. Longtime fan. I guess I wanted to represent myself as sort of a typical poorly informed American spectator to this discussion and say, look, the choices I see being put out in front of us are a slow ratcheting up of climate change, you know, probably maybe sort of caused by man-made activities, versus economic catastrophe by cutting off the oil supply, which is sort of almost a certainty. And of those two choices, Americans are mostly, you know, going to go with the second. It's not a totally irrational choice, and that might sort of account for our national decision. Just wanted to get your reaction from your two guests, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. We thank you for that.
Yeah, I mean, Bruce, I agree with
Paul
you if that is the choice, but that's not the choice. And I agree with you in the sense that that is how it's being positioned politically, but that's not the right choice. The fact is that, you know, we've leveled off on our use of oil, and we can greatly reduce it in ways that produce jobs. I mean, the three main sources of greenhouse gases are agriculture, transportation, the built environment. And in each of those areas, the innovations that are possible and the job creation that's possible is fantastic. I mean, the greatest job creation mechanism we know of is retrofitting the built environment. It has the most number of jobs per $1 million invested, and it has the highest return on investment. And so when we think of energy coming in or energy coming in a pipeline or energy being combusted. But the major source of energy in the United States is the energy that we can save. It's the cheapest energy. It puts people back to work. There is – and I wrote about this with my co-author Emmy Lovins in 99, but there, we can save 80% of the energy that we presently use in the United States and create a much better lifestyle, much more livable cities, much healthier buildings, and a much more restorative agricultural system than we have right
all
now.
All it requires is the political will. But boy, that's a big requirement.
Well, that political will is going to start building in part because the economics, there's the other side to the economics too. And that's the cost of not doing anything. My home state of Vermont just had, as I said, because of climate change, the worst flooding we've ever experienced. I mean, rain, we had about 20% more rain in a day than had ever fallen there in the 250 years people were keeping records, okay? The cost of dealing, we're not going to do anything in Vermont for the next 10 years except try to find the money to somehow rebuild roads and bridges and that sort of thing. Our economic life took a dark turn, just like is going on in Texas right now or going on in places around the world. If we don't deal with this pretty soon, climate change, there's not enough money in the world to bail us out.
It's an interesting remark, actually a question from a listener up in Marin named Lori, who writes, my college-age daughter was arrested on the last day of the Keystone protests in Washington, D.C., over 1,200 people arrested in front of the White House. And virtually no media coverage of the protest, notwithstanding this hour of forum. Was the protest too peaceful for the mainstream media to cover? Seriously, why did this protest get so little press ink? A proud mom, she signs it, by the way.
And many thanks to her for raising a child who would come and do that. Actually, we got quite a bit of press, and it's continuing to kind of build. We really did manage to put this thing on the map in a way that it wasn't before. Now, the default for the media always is to just imagine that people who protest things are sort of marginal figures. And it takes a while to get through that and whatever. I'm not that worried about it.
Well, but as you said, there was an editorial in the New York Times.
The New York Times, that helped a lot. And I'm not worried about it in a sense because increasingly we're able in the meantime to kind of make our own media too. This word is out there that we managed to get 1,200 people from every state in the union, literally, to show up and get arrested. Is a sign that people are now hearing about something that no one knew about even a couple of months ago.
Madeline says, what's the Lakoff-style frame that would best respond to pipeline proponents' argument that the U.S. needs the jobs to be created by the pipeline? In other words, I think she's right to raise this as a framing question. How do you frame it from your side?
I think the
– Save the planet, basically,
well,
isn't it?
Well, save the planet, that's a useful thing to be doing. And in terms of jobs, the jobs really come the day that we get serious about the energy transition. You get a few jobs for a few years building a pipeline, but that's it doesn't take anybody to run a pipeline once it's up and built, you know. The jobs that are going to come – by the hundreds of thousands are when we finally get around to getting people up on the roof, putting in the sort of things that we need up there now.
Listening to Forum, we're talking with Bill McKibben and Paul Hawken. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny, and we're going to go to a break here in just a second. I want to read a quick note from Sarah. It says, I'd like to see President Obama ask every household and business to reduce their energy, water, and gas consumption by 7%. We're fighting two wars, watching our world heat up, yet most of us have not been asked or required to sacrifice. Again, this is a fundraising period. For more information about how to support this radio station, which we hope you will be not only inclined to do but passionate about doing, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And more of your calls will go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Patrick, good morning. Another framing question, huh, Patrick? Hi.
Yes, sir. How are you guys doing?
Okay.
Good. This is my question. I feel like whenever anyone brings up the word climate change, it's almost similar to the abortion debate. People immediately jump yes or no, and there's no changing anybody's mind. So I almost feel like arguing climate change is useless these days. Is there any merit in framing it as a conservation movement, which is less polarizing, and ultimately that's what, I mean, fixing climate change is about, is conserving everything that we have. And I'll take my comment off here.
Okay, thank you for the call, Paul Hawken.
I think it's a great comment, and it's a great suggestion. We have to disaggregate climate change into two areas. One is the physics, which is the pure science, and that is unimpeachable. The mechanism of climate change is triatomic particles in the upper stratosphere vibrating by a certain frequency and redirecting the heat that would normally escape back to the Earth. I mean, there's not one scientist in the world that will contradict that. The debate is over the interpretation of the effects it will have over the short and long term. And that's always going to be subject to interpretation because that's predictive, and science doesn't do prediction very well, and it shouldn't. In that sense. But in terms of the – I think that another way to look at it is really no regrets, which is what path can we take where if we're completely wrong about climate change, we'll have no regrets whatsoever about the path we took. And if we take that path and climate change is as virulent as it is being predicted to be, we will have no regrets about which path we took. And that no regrets path is very much the one you mentioned, which is it's about conservation. It's about changing the way we use energy. It's about using it much more effectively, about changing the built environment and the ways in which we interrelate with respect to this. I mean, the United States, thermodynamically speaking, is only 2% efficient. That is, only 2% of the energy we burn, combust, you know, and use actually does work. And the other 98% of that energy, according to the National Academy of Engineering, the NAE, is wasted. So there's plenty of room here for us to save and create jobs.
Bill McKibben.
And just to go back to the very good frame that your caller suggested, one of the things that was kind of funny and interesting about these protests were we told everybody, if you want to come get arrested, we need you wearing a necktie or a dress, okay? And the reason was, we wanted to demonstrate to people who the conservatives and who the radicals in this fight actually are, okay? Radicals are people who are – and companies mostly – who are willing to alter the chemical composition of the atmosphere once they've been warned by science that this is a ruinous course, okay? The wildest-eyed San Francisco hippie and his most ambitious moment in the 1960s never thought of a plan – one-tenth as radical as that. In some sense, those of us who – I mean, Abby Hoffman freaked everybody out by threatening to drop LSD in a reservoir someplace, right? I mean, you know, very minor league stuff compared to what Exxon does every day of the year. And so we wanted to show people that in that sense, those of us out there getting arrested, you know, who only want to keep the world in something like the shape it was when we were born, we're kind of the conservatives in this fight.
Could have made a black tie, actually. Had you thought about
that? That might have been a little over the top. I only have one suit. I'm a country boy, and I normally only wear my tie for weddings and funerals. I made the mistake of, when I got arrested, I got to sleep in my suit for the next 3 nights in the jail. So I may not really have any suit left at all at this point. But
let me get another quick call on. Catherine, that's you. Hi. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning. I'm a longtime veteran of fighting against climate change and bad air quality here in Sacramento, the capital. And we're doing pretty well, doing better than the rest of the country on reducing our energy use. I want to hark back to World War II and also before that, the Depression. Would hope that Obama would look at FDR's effectiveness in fighting against corporate interests in starting a big infrastructure program in the 30s, and then also gearing up the country for war in World War II, where we sacrificed. We had the 3 gallons a week of gasoline, and we questioned whether a trip was necessary.
And Catherine, and I'm afraid we're pretty short on time. Let me just extrapolate a bit from that. We've got seconds left here, but again, it's how much you can get strength behind a movement that she's talking about. Certainly, with the New Deal, with World War II, there was, and Bill, we haven't seen anything like this, like what you're doing. I don't think since the Civil Rights Movement.
We haven't seen it in a while.
And the Vietnam War protests.
There's no guarantee we're going to win, but damn it, we're going to fight right through this thing because it's a big deal.
Onward, upward, and thank you so much for all you're doing, both of you. Paul Hawk and Bill McKibben, good to have you both with us. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. And I want to remind you, our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our producers are Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Thanks to all of you for being with us on Forum this morning. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.